All right, and as council is approaching and getting settled, I'll reintroduce our panel. My name is Keala Eid. I'm serving as presiding judge today. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'm joined by Judge Johnson and Judge Kirk. This is the third case on our oral argument calendar this morning. This is A240464 in the matter of the trusteeships under the trust indentures between the City of Edwardsville, Kansas, and UMB Bank, N.A., as successor trustee. Council, just a couple of housekeeping matters. The podium is adjustable. There's a switch on the front if you'd like to use it. Council, for the appellant, will have 15 minutes for your initial argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Council, for respondent, you'll have 15 minutes. There is a recording being made of these proceedings. It'll be available on our website this afternoon or tomorrow. That is the only recording that's to be made. We are streaming on the internet as well. When you begin your argument, please introduce yourself and who you represent. Let us know how you'd like us to refer to you. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready, proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Virginia McCalmont, and I represent the appellant, 110 Hotel HRKC. This case is about a Hard Rock Hotel that was supposed to be built in Kansas. And it is undisputed that the hotel was not built. It doesn't exist. But what is disputed, what is in fact hotly disputed, is why the hotel wasn't built, whose fault it is, and when it became inevitable that the project was going to fail. There are two parties here today. I represent 110, as we just discussed. There's also UMB Bank, who is the trustee for municipal bond funds that were to be used to construct the project. And the two parties that are here today, which are the same two parties who litigated this matter below, they are two of literally dozens of parties that are embroiled in litigation about the failure of this project in state and federal courts in Kansas and Missouri. And similarly, the handful of issues that are for this court to resolve are just a few of the literally dozens of issues related to the failure of this project that are still being actively litigated just down the road from where the project was to be constructed. Now, I mentioned that this is a small piece of a much broader universe of litigation, because it makes clear that if ever there was a case where it matters to hold the parties to their pleadings, for the reasons that we require parties to be limited to their pleadings because of notice and an opportunity for people to participate or not, and for this court and others to be able to apply res judicata. If those factors matter anywhere, they matter here. They matter in this case. It is almost certain that whatever this court decides, that what the district court decided, that those are going to be issues that are argued about, what they mean, how far they go, in those cases that continue to be litigated elsewhere. And unfortunately, that is what the district court in this case did not do. The district court did not hold the trustee to its pleadings in two different ways. One is the district court relied on events and occurrences entirely separate from what was pled in the petition that happened after the petition was filed, even though the trustee could have and did not move to supplement or amend its pleading. And then entirely separately, the district court relied on a theory of relief that was, again, separate from what was in the petition and had not been pled, even though the trustee could have supplemented, and that was not litigated by consent.
Ms. McCalmont, why did you not? I'm curious about the way you've sort of packaged the first issue. I mean, why did you not challenge the denial of the motion in limine? Because it seems like, you know, I mean, if you're right about the pleadings, then the, you know, some evidence that was offered about later events would have been irrelevant, should have been excluded, and so on. And then, but normally, if evidence is admitted, then the district judge can do whatever he or she wants with it, I guess, subject to the legal basis, but it seems like you're avoiding the issue of the admission of the evidence, and you're focusing instead on pleadings. I mean, why should we look at this through the rules of civil procedure instead of the rules of evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, because the I'm not intending to avoid it. From our perspective, we are challenging the denial of the motion in limine. We made every effort to preserve this issue before, during, and
I don't think that issue is briefed. I mean, it's kind of an underlying issue or premise, but it's not. I mean, you haven't asked us to reverse on the ground the district court erred by denying your motion in limine, correct?
I suppose that's right, Your Honor. We didn't phrase it that way. I think from our perspective, asking the court to reverse for the reasons that we articulated is functionally also reversing on the grounds of the denial of the motion in limine. From our perspective, this is not an evidentiary issue because it's not a question of whether the evidence was relevant or not relevant. It's a question of whether the evidence, it's a question of what was in the pleadings, like whether this was going to go outside the scope of the pleadings. And so it's not within the court's discretion to grant or to not grant the admission of that evidence. It's not an abuse of discretion issue. It's an issue of law. I think that's best exemplified by the Walzak case that we cite in our briefing. Whether something is within the scope of pleadings is an issue of court procedure that is subject to de novo review. And so again, the issue is really how should the trustees' pleadings be construed, and that's the error rather than the admission or not admission of the evidence.
Could I call your attention to page 46 of your addendum? That's the last page of the petition, which is the request for relief, and there's basically seven paragraphs where petitioner, you know, is asking for instructions. I feel like maybe that's how we should measure whether or not the district court resolved issues that weren't pleaded. But, I mean, are you saying that the district court's order went beyond those seven requests for relief?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, you said page 46
46, of the addendum. 46, I think, is what I meant to say.
Okay. Just let me get there.
Are you referring to number seven on that?
Well, I'm referring to all seven. Okay. I mean, these seven paragraphs, I think, are essentially the specific instructions that the petitioner was seeking, and it's within the prayer for relief part of the petition.
Yes, Your Honor, we do believe that the court went considerably beyond the request for relief that the trustees submitted. I'll direct the court to the first paragraph, which is declaring and confirming that uncured events of default have occurred under the indentures. That's, to us, that is what this case is about, is there needed to be uncured events of default as those terms are defined in the indentures, and they have very specific definitions with requirements about notice and.
So you read that to say, sorry to interrupt, but you read that to say sort of have occurred as of the date of the petition?
Yes.
Okay. But, I mean, isn't that just sort of inconsistent with the nature of a trustee instruction action, which is, you know, it's forward-looking, it's seeking permission, in a sense, for what the trustee should do in the future, and so it seems to me kind of artificial to suspend, you know, I mean, to disallow any evidence about what occurs in the interval, long interval in this case, between the petition and the ultimate decision. That just doesn't seem realistic.
Yeah, respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. And I think the issue in this case is that the events of default that we're talking about were fundamentally different. So the events of default, there is a requirement that events of default have occurred for the trustee to be able to come and bring this petition. And so because of the requirements of the indentures and the development agreement, so that was a predicate to bringing suit. And those events of default, if it were the same events of default and new things happened, I think that's a closer case.
Well, why shouldn't we see, I'm sorry to interrupt, why shouldn't we see the events of default alleged in the petition as ripening seeds of what ultimately the district court relied on deciding that events of default had occurred by the time of its decision?
Yes, Your Honor, respectfully, they aren't the same seeds. So what is in the petition are very specific alleged events of default, and I use that term advisedly. We don't think they were. We spent 5 days at a bench trial proving that the things that the trustee had provided notice and an opportunity to cure to our clients, that those were not events of default. And then the events of default that the court subsequently relied on in granting the relief sought in the petition, The court actually is not very specific about what it's referring to. It talks about performance milestones. Again, I think this is a point that matters quite a lot, because if the court traces through the performance milestones, again, there wasn't a lot of evidence about this at trial, and for a lot of those, there wasn't notice and an opportunity to cure, so they're not events of default anyway.
Didn't you actually make a strategic decision not to offer evidence to respond to events of default that occurred after the petition? I think you make this point in your reply brief a couple times, because you wanted to preserve an argument that you weren't consenting to litigation, right?
That's correct.
But the reason why I'm troubled by that is that, you know, you also make a strong argument that you've preserved the fact that you didn't consent to litigation by virtue of the motion in limine, right? I mean, that is essentially the point at which you said, we don't want the court to consider anything that happened after the petition if they didn't amend their petition. So how can it be both ways that, you know, if you preserved it by virtue of the motion in limine, why couldn't you have offered evidence in response to events of default occurring after the petition was filed, given that you had a ruling from the court that was adverse to you, right? I mean, couldn't you have said, we respect the court's ruling and stand on our objection, but now I'm going to offer evidence and challenge these events of default that occurred afterwards?
We actually didn't have a ruling from the court that was adverse to us, so the court took that part of the motion in limine under advisement, and we made a continuing objection at trial. The court conditionally admitted the evidence, which the trustee had represented at the motion in limine hearing, was going to be profoundly limited in scope, because this case was going to be about the events of default that were pled in the petition, and this additional evidence was going to be offered for the limited purpose of providing context for what happened. And then the court overruled or denied the motion in limine in its post-trial ruling. And so at the time that we were at trial, first of all, it was already a trial that was going longer than people thought it was going to, because I think, frankly, the trustee was surprised by how much we were able to contest the idea that the things that they had pled weren't events of default. And so this additional issue, again, without a clear ruling from the court, we didn't want to get in there. It's also, frankly, with how much happened afterward, and again, this is the subject of a very actively litigated lawsuit between 24 parties in the District of Kansas, it would have taken weeks to get into the full story of what happened and whose fault it was, if there even had been specificity about what things we were talking about after the petition, which there really wasn't.
And then my other follow-up on Judge Johnson's question earlier about the seven paragraphs at the end of the petition is, why shouldn't we consider paragraph 4, which is stated much more broadly? I mean, even if we agree with you about events of default have occurred means events of default before the petition, and then paragraph 2, the events of default, is still referring to those events of default that might have occurred before the petition, why shouldn't we consider authorizing and instructing the trustee to take such other actions as are consistent with and reasonably necessary to protect the assets of the trust estates and the best interests of the bondowners, .. Why should we consider that as broad enough to give you notice that events of default that followed the filing of the petition would be considered by the district court?
Yeah, Your Honor, because that would be inconsistent with Minnesota's notice pleading requirement, and trust instruction proceedings, like any other civil proceeding, are subject to the rules of civil procedure as long as they aren't inconsistent, as long as the trust rules aren't inconsistent with the rules of civil procedure, and they aren't in this case. And the trustee is asking this court to look at its petition from that level of generality to say, look, we said tell us to do whatever it makes sense, and so we get to talk about whatever. But as we pointed out in our briefing, first, I think that's inconsistent with the requirements of ripeness, that matters be ripe before they're brought to court. It would mean that there's no point in having a rule to supplement your pleadings, because the whole point of Rule 15.04 is to allow a party to bring in matters that postdate the filing of its petition or complaint. The trustee didn't do that here. I don't know why. I presume it was strategic. They could have done. If a pleading can embrace things that happen later, there would be no reason to have that rule. And as we also explained in our briefing, it's the level of generality at which the trustee...
That presumes that the petition itself wasn't, and that paragraph 4 wasn't pled sufficiently, right? I mean, that an amendment was required, right? That's...
Yeah, Your Honor, that supplementation was required.
Supplementation was required.
Yes, and I think it has to be, because there's no dispute that the issues on which the court relied happened after the petition was filed. And so that's why the supplementation rule exists, is to allow parties to bring matters that postdate the filing of the complaint or the petition into scope. So yes, but I think that's inherent in the setup here. As we also pointed out, this is the rule of res judicata in Minnesota is that res judicata does not bar a party from later bringing claims that could have been but were not brought into a proceeding. You would expect the rule to be the opposite if the level of generality was such that the trustee could say, you know, tell us to do what makes sense, and that means that we can talk about anything that happened at any point in time. And the last point that I'll make about that is also just to ask this court to think about the hypothetical, about what this means. Again, I recognize this is a trust instruction proceeding. It really is just civil litigation. Imagine what it would mean if someone who's bringing an excessive force claim can say, I'm the victim of excessive force. This officer did this bad thing to me. At that level of generality, and at the time the petition or complaint is brought, it's this person maced me in the shower, and then by the time we get to trial, there's been another incident and somebody tased them in the lunchroom. Notice pleading clearly wouldn't allow you to talk about an entirely separate incident unless you amended or supplemented. That's essentially the situation here, and that's why we believe the district court's order should be reversed and the case remanded for further proceedings.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Krause, counsel for respondent UMB Bank as trustee. The district court's post-trial orders should be affirmed. This is an appeal from an equitable proceeding, and the purpose of this equitable proceeding was to preserve trust assets, and that's what the district court did here. The bond owners paid money for 110 to build the hotel project. But the hotel project was not built, and with no hotel project, there were no revenues to repay the bonds. None of these facts is in dispute. And with no source of repayment, the district court determined it was equitable to return the money to the bond owners and not to pay even more money to 110.
On the more money, that involves the third request for payment, correct? The payments over $9 million that had previously been made in it?
Yes, Your Honor. There were previously two cost certifications, one and two, that were, as Your Honor noted, about $9 million. And then at issue then was the third request, cost cert number three, as the parties have called it, for about $830,000.
And was everyone aware, or was it just 110 that was aware of all the problems with financing that were occurring in that short time frame before that request?
By the time that request was made, I think, to use Your Honor's words, everyone was aware, because on March 17th of 2020, and cost cert number three is dated, I believe, May 1st of 2020, but on March 17th of 2020, there was a notice put out on what's called EMMA, which is the way of distributing information to all of the interested parties, all of the bond owners, that there was no construction funding, that 110 had not received private construction funding that it was required, that was a condition precedent, and also that as a result that construction was suspended. So that fact was known generally to those who were involved in the project at that time.
There was still an approval, though, by the city of that additional payment of what, $800,000 or $900,000.
There was, Your Honor, and if I may give them the context for that, the city's role is different than the trustee's role. The city's role in terms of approving cost certifications was to review the expenses and determine that they were eligible expenses. It's even more complicated process, as you can imagine, in terms of looking at all the different receipts and determining which bucket they fall into, and do they qualify as eligible expenses for reimbursement? And that's the city's role. It's an administrative, non-discretionary task that the city engages in, the city manager and the city attorney, and both of them testified at trial about this. That's the city's role. The trustee's role then is to make determination whether to disperse the funds once the city has said at least that they're at least eligible for, the expenses are eligible for reimbursement. And in this case, the trustee declined to do so because for the trustee to disperse funds, the trustee has to receive a certification from 110 that there were no events of default under the development agreement and no events at that time that with notice or the passage of time or both would ripen into an event of default under the development agreement. 110 was required to certify to that and was required to put in a certification that the trustee then was determined was properly completed in all respects. With the knowledge that was out there for everyone, bond owners, the trustee, that construction was suspended, that there was no private financing, which is about $50 million out of the $80 million total contemplated for the project, the trustee determined that this was a false certification, was not properly completed in all respects, and appropriately exercised its discretion to decline to pay that certification.
And up to that time, though, the payments that had been made out of the bond proceeds, not out of any loan from Altos.
That's right. There had been nothing paid from any loan from Altos. Everything that was paid, the $9 million, was paid exclusively from bond proceeds.
With respect to appellant's first argument, I'd like to ask you a question about the prayer for relief and the petition, the same page that I was referring to with Ms. McElmont. So can you show us how the challenged analysis and conclusions of the district court, how they fit within these seven paragraphs in the prayer for relief?
Certainly, Your Honor. I would point to, in particular, two of the paragraphs, and I think actually they're both ones that have been previously discussed. Number one, declaring and confirming that uncured events of default have occurred under the indentures. And then the second is paragraph number four, authorizing and instructing the trustee to take such other actions as are consistent with and reasonably necessary to protect the assets of the trust estates and the best interests of the bond owners, including upon direction, and I won't read every word of it, authorizing the redemption of certain of the bonds, which means in this context, paying out bond proceeds to bond owners. And so both those go directly to what is at issue here. It's the trustee requesting judicial guidance under the TIP statute, trust instruction proceeding statute, on how to distribute trust assets because 110 wasn't complying with its contractual obligations. It's the trustee asking the court, should all trust funds be made available to distribution to bond owners on direction, or was the trustee required to pay that $830,000 that 110 demanded on cost certification number three? And so those two certainly capture both those both those issues. And what's more, the petition set forth the key facts in support of the core theory. Core theory, again, being we need judicial guidance on how to distribute assets because 110 isn't complying with its contractual obligations. And there's different ways of getting there. You can get there in part because of events of default that have occurred and are continuing. You can get there also because there's a failure to comply with contractual obligations such that it's not in the best interests of bond owners to pay even more money to 110. And critically, the petition set forth the core facts in support of the theory. I think one thing we heard earlier was an analogy to entirely different facts coming in. And whether or not that would make a difference, I'm not going to focus on. But what I will say is that that's not this case. When you look at the petition, petition says 110 had none of the private funding needed to build the hotel project, and all construction had been suspended as a result. The petition says that 110 is still demanding that $830,000 of bond proceeds, even though there's no path to build the hotel and no path to repay the bond owners. Each of those facts was still true at the time of trial. Those are the facts upon which the court granted the requested relief at trial and then reinforced in its post-trial motion, in its post-trial orders.
The court characterizes the events of default as being uncured events of default that have now occurred as of the time of the findings of fact and conclusion of law, including that the principal and interest on the bonds were not timely paid. So do you, I guess, disagree with the district court's characterization that that's not actually tied back to the facts alleged in the petition that you were just referencing, that timely payments of principal and interest would not occur?
No, I agree with the district court on that. I mean, that is, and if I misspoke, I apologize.
But no, I guess what I'm suggesting is, it seems like you're pointing to facts alleged in the petition, not in the instructions themselves, that would indicate that the court's finding that the principal and interest, or conclusion that principal and interest in the bonds were not timely paid, was a fact alleged in the petition, or that would occur. Did I understand you correctly?
You did. Okay. You did understand me correctly, Your Honor. You
know, that's not in the instructions, or the requested instructions. It's not alleged as a specific event of default in the instructions.
It's not alleged in a specific event of default in the instructions. The instructions don't allege a specific event of default. They request the instruction that declaring and confirming that uncured events of default.
I was just looking at it. There's paragraph 31 has five bullet points, and those that are the breaches that were alleged. And then 32 says it's the trustee's position that these actions and omissions constitute events of default under the indentures. And it doesn't look like the timely payment of principal and interest was included among those five bullet points, right?
It is not included in
those
five.
Or even the anticipated inability to timely pay principal and interest, right?
That's right. And I will note that those five bullet points do include the very last bullet point, which is failure to conduct adequate due diligence to ensure no other events of default have occurred under the development agreement, and the owner and developer are clearly unequivocally able to strictly perform in accordance herewith. Now, that's not necessarily the best example of the English language being used by the legalese, but it gets to the exact same point that we're talking about, that the owner and the developer, 110, was not able to assure or demonstrate to the trustee, to the bond owners, that it was on a path to comply with the performance milestones, that it was on a path to comply with the development agreement. And as a result, ultimately what was going to happen was that the bonds would not be able to be repaid timely or at all. And all of that is in the petition. The petition alleges over and over the issues about failure to build the hotel, failure to keep building the hotel, failure to get the financing, and the fact that without financing and without construction, there was no way for the bond owners to be repaid. That is a running theme throughout the petition, and it more than satisfies Rule 8. Rule 8 just requires that short and plain statement. Minnesota, as we all know, requires only notice pleading. It relies on discovery to flesh out the particulars. And here 110 chose not to conduct any discovery, but that doesn't change the Minnesota Hornbook law, that 801 requires only a broad general statement, non-technical broad brush pleadings, that the focus is on the incident rather than the specific facts of the incident.
It's a little concerning though, right, that the district court skipped over any event of default that occurred prior to the petition. And I mean, at least the district court didn't seem to embrace what you're arguing here, is that last bullet point would have encompassed at the very least the failure to timely pay.
Because ultimately the district court didn't need to get, excuse me, I apologize, didn't need to get there, because of the events of default that had occurred and were continuing by the time of trial, which were the same facts that were alleged in the petition. It's not a situation where the petition is alleging facts over here on Mars, and then, you know, by the time of trial, we're arguing about something on Saturn. It's the same facts that have simply, frankly, remained true at the time of trial. I mean, that's, and so therefore, the district court didn't need to go there because the district court could look and say, look, we haven't, you know, exactly what's in the petition has played out, undisputed. They still don't have financing, private financing. Hotel hasn't been built. In fact, the construction permit expired even in May of 2020, one of the facts that was proven at trial, even before the petition. And the bond owners have not been repaid. There hasn't been any source of repayment for the bond owners, and they have been repaid. It's exactly what the petition alleges, and it's exactly what then the district court found. You know, when, and so he just didn't, the court didn't need to go where, to look deeper. And, you know, on this issue of what's sufficient under Rule 8, I do want to point to a case from this court, In re Foley. It's from 2003, published case. It's one of the seminal case on tips. And there, the court held that it was unnecessary to amend the petition to more specifically describe the equitable issues for resolution because they were already outlined in the petition, satisfying Rule 8. And I won't go into all the details, but essentially this court held that because the petition set forth sort of the underlying facts and explained the impact of those facts and then sought an order more generally instructing the trustees as to the division of trust assets, that was more than enough, even though some of the specific issues at trial were not raised specifically or flagged, I should say, in the petition. They were subsumed. And that's the case here. Everything that we litigated at trial was subsumed within the petition. There was no error of law. There was no abuse of discretion in denying motions in limine, in denying post-trial relief. And for those reasons, the district court's orders should be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I'd like to start where counsel left off, which is this idea of events of default and which events of default we're talking about. Again, what we heard from counsel for the respondent is asking this court to view the petition at a level of generality that just says the hotel project didn't get built, so that everything that happened related to that is subsumed within this project. But as a very practical example of why this matters, Your Honor was asking about paragraph 31 of the petition and the events of default that are alleged there. Those events of default are actually alleged against the issuer, which is the city. Those are about things that the trustee said the city hadn't done, not 110. Similarly, one of the performance milestone issues that the district court relied on, again, there's not a lot of detail in what the district court says about exactly which events of default it concluded had occurred and were continuing and justified the relief, but it mentions performance milestones. And the first performance milestone that wasn't met wasn't actually 110's performance milestone. It was the performance milestone of an entirely separate entity, related but separate, Compass Commodity, that was responsible for Retail Area 2. Now, I mention all of that because this just underscores why the requirement of notice pleading is so important. It's so that people know what we're talking about so that the right people can show up and protect their rights. And so to allow the goalposts to shift in the way that the trustee is asking for the goalposts to shift would mean that the right people aren't getting notice of what's happening and don't know that they need to be there to protect their rights. These events of default, they're directed to different people, to different circumstances.
I think the reason why I referenced paragraph 31 in particular is that in your reply brief, you wrote the events of default alleged by UMB in its petition were, and then you picked three examples, I think, from addendum 42. I do see that it does reference the issuer, the city, there. but is that a distinction that is, I mean, is that all you wish to say on that? I guess my other question was going to be about the argument they made about the last bullet point and how broadly that should be read in that paragraph 31. I'm trying to navigate back to it.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. So I can say that we approach trial ready to deal with whatever events of default appeared in the petition. And from our perspective, there were two different buckets. There were those that were alleged as to 110 under the development agreement, and there were those that were alleged as to the city, which was a separate notice, which is what paragraph 31 is about. The trustee didn't end up talking about the paragraph 31 defaults at trial, I think, at all. Essentially, and so from our perspective, neither of those buckets of alleged events of default are actually events of default, which again is what we had a 5-day bench trial proving. So yes. And then on the question of how broadly the last paragraph should be read, I mean, again, I'll just go back to if we're operating at the level of generality that says we can just say this bad thing happened and we don't have to be specific about what it is, there's no need for notice pleading at all because the theory can be changed by trial and then the court can't apply res judicata because it's, and people don't have notice of what it is that they're supposed to be there arguing. We showed up to trial and argued the things that we were on notice about. And then after trial, the court made it about a bunch of other things that weren't in the petition and that we didn't have the opportunity to present evidence about. And that's why notice pleading exists, is to prevent that from happening.
With respect to your second issue, respondent responds by pointing out that because there was the funding was lost, then 110 was in breach of sections 401, 501C of the development agreement. And I think in continuing so, but I think also in breach as of May of 2020 when invoice number 3 was issued, but then I think on a continuing basis after that. Can you, in your reply brief, I don't think you specifically respond to that, but can you give us your position about whether or not there was a breach based on the lack of funding, either, you know, from May 2020 forward?
Yes, Your
Both,
Honor.
Both, I guess. Both May 2020 and the period after the petition.
Yes, Your Honor. There was not a breach related to funding as of May 2020. The requirements under the documents were that 110 close on a construction loan. 110 did close on a construction loan. All of the evidence at trial was that the construction loan closed on October 30th, 2019. I see I'm out of time. May I? Okay. And so that construction loan closed, so there was no breach there. 110, again, that.
But what about, if I may follow up, Judge Eade?
Oh, please.
I mean, but then after the closing, there was some subsequent events which were present, I think, at the time invoice number 3 was submitted, right? And I mean, according to respondent's brief, I'm looking at page 24, that the developer has to certify that there's no current event that is in breach or would be in breach with the passage of time. That seems persuasive to me. Can you address that a little bit more specifically?
Sure. So the first point is that I don't believe this is an issue that this court needs to get to because I think this is an in the alternative
argument.
The first set of issues, which I think are dispositive here. But on that issue specifically, this is not an issue that was litigated at all. A lot of the arguments and citations that showed up in the trustee's brief, this appeal was the first time that we had seen reference to any of them. But having spent a lot of time with the trust indentures and with the development agreement, as of May 2020, there was not a breach under the agreement. This idea of the certification related to events that with the notice and passage of time could become events of default, there's a lot of contract interpretation baked into that. The certification has to be properly completed in all respects. The district court didn't get into any of this because it wasn't briefed by anybody because it fundamentally isn't an issue here. It's an issue in Kansas, which is why we think it was error for the court to get to it. We also think the court was simply wrong. You know, Section 403B of the development of the indentures say that the trustee shall disperse the funds. Counsel talked about the role of the city versus the role of the trustee. We disagree. We think that what counsel argued is contrary to the roles as set forth in the development agreement and the indentures. And at the end of the day, shall mean shall. The trustee was required to disperse the funds, and it didn't do so.
Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments, counsel. The matter is submitted. We will issue a decision in the statutory timeframe.
Your Honor.